From Iowa Public Radio News, this is The Exchange. Today, we have an archive edition of our program. For the first half, a conversation host Ben Kiefer had in July of last year about an archaeological dig site in southeast Iowa near Oakville. More than 100,000 artifacts have been uncovered there, and they give clues about how people lived 1,700 years ago. And in the second half, a conversation about the history of papermaking 1,300 years ago, and how advances in the field landed Timothy Barrett of the University of Iowa Center for the Book a $500,000 award. Tim was a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship in September of last year. That's all coming up on The Exchange.
This is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer, and you're listening to an archive edition of our program today. For our first half hour, let's go back to a time before radio, a time before Iowa, or even the founding of this country, before even the discovery of the Americas by Europeans. A new archaeological site near Oakville in southeastern Iowa tells us a little bit about what life was like in this area some 1,700 years ago. The people were hunter-gatherers who also grew native crops like sunflower seeds. Joining me to tell us more about this rich archaeological site that was discovered and the life here nearly 2,000 years ago are Dave Benn. He is a research archaeologist with Bear Creek Archaeology. That's a private company based in Cresco, Iowa, that does archaeology. Also joining us, Joe Arzt. He is the director of the geospatial program with the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa. Dave and Joe, welcome to you both.
Greetings.
Let's talk about what you found. You spent, I understand, 8 weeks excavating at this site in the dead of winter, January and February. Dave, what did you find?
We excavated a village of the Weaver people. Weaver is an archaeological term for people who lived a long time ago and lived in this particular area. And the village is what we call a ring village. It's a donut-shaped village with houses very close together in a ring around an open central plaza. And
how big is the ring approximately?
Oh, it's about 220 feet in diameter at least, perhaps a little bigger than that. And It's a rather compact village. The houses are quite close together, and these folks probably were all closely related to one another. Mm-hmm. They had lived together for a long time, and they probably intermarried.
You said compact as if that's a bit of a surprise. Is that surprising, unusual? I mean, there were, of course, plenty of space at this time.
Yeah, hunters and gatherers around the world tend to live in dispersed communities. They don't tend to cluster in very large numbers of people, and they like to move out and get away from each other sometimes. And this village looks a little unusual in the sense that it's very compact. The houses are very close together.
Mm-hmm. So how significant is this discovery? How often does something like this come along?
We know of two of these villages in Iowa. There are a few more over in Illinois. The significance of this site is that it's below the plow zone, and it's very, very well preserved, which is unusual for many sites in the Midwest, which tend to get plowed and disturbed by roads and other kinds of things. So it's nice to find something that's almost in pristine condition.
For you as an archaeologist, I assume decades in the business, how often do you find something like this in this area?
Oh, maybe every decade you run onto a nice site like this one. It's really worth working on and preserving.
So talk specifically about the artifacts that you found. You excavated a cross-section, a slice, a trench that ran dead center through this village, right?
A little off-center. We essentially excavated the portion that's called the exploratory trench, which is underneath the levee that they're going to build. So we had a rather narrow trench, but we recovered well over 200,000 artifacts that we've so far got cataloged.
200,000?
Oh, yeah.
What are those artifacts?
Fire rock, pieces of debris from chipping stone tools, animal bones, pottery sherds, Anything you can think of that people need to live by. And, of course, it's all in small pieces, so that's why the numbers are so large.
So there's a lot of work yet to be done in evaluating, looking at this, documenting it, preserving it, and then figuring out what it could mean?
Yeah, we're going to take a few months here to even get the stuff all washed and cataloged and sorted. And we brought back a lot of dirt samples, which we have to wash the artifacts out of. This is all standard technique, but it takes a long time to do this, just the mundane work of working through the artifacts.
Mm-hmm. So give us a little bit of the backstory of how this site was discovered. I understand it's connected with the floods of last summer.
Yeah, the city of Oakville got flooded in June, and FEMA and the Corps of Engineers moved in shortly after to try to figure out how to repair the levees down there. And whenever the federal government gets involved in a construction project, they do environmental impact studies, and one of those is archaeology. So last fall, we did an archaeological survey of the floodplain where the new levee is going to go. And we found several sites, this being the best one of the whole bunch of sites that were out there.
Mm-hmm. Was there a moment you were actually in the field, discovered this? Was there a moment when you realized this is it? This is a gold mine?
Yeah. We put what we call bucket augering. We were putting in small holes across the floodplain, and bang, we ran into a bucket auger that was full of bones and potsherds and
wow.
kinds of stuff. So you go, wow, there's a village underneath here. We couldn't see it because there were 4 or 5 feet of levee sand sitting on top of it, and it was completely invisible.
Mm-hmm. Joe Arts, talk a little bit more about how floods connect with archaeological sites. I understand they work to – sometimes they destroy sites. Sometimes they preserve them, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think what Ben was – or what Dave was just saying that the that particular site was covered over by sediments that had just been deposited by that particular flood, right, Dave? Yeah. And so that's an instance where the archaeological record is actually getting preserved by flood sediments.
Mm-hmm. So everything underneath that is in good shape, even though we've got several feet of water above even the sand from the levee.
Right, yeah. The sand is getting washed over the site and is essentially preserving it intact. Of course, there are lots of other instances where if the flood is scouring, it can carve into the archaeological site. Mm-hmm. Or if the banks are meandering, cutting into the site, that'll be destroying the site.
And in that case, you find evidence of that because you look in the stream and there might be bone fragments that have drifted downstream?
You find the bone fragments right on the beaches along the river. This particular levee destruction at Oakville exposed sites and covered them up both. Both things were happening down there. We're fortunate that this site got covered instead of getting scoured out by the floods.
Mm-hmm. If we look at the if you look at the map around Oakville, the Iowa River is just before it meets the Mississippi at this point at Oakville, and it takes a bend there. And Oakville, it has to change course. Otherwise, if it would continue on, it would be going into Oakville, right?
Yes.
And so that bend is what is causing the need for a levee because there would be otherwise it washed away, right?
The river wants to do what it wants to do. And human beings seem to want to make rivers do things that they don't want to do. So that's the difficulty here. It's an impasse.
I understand that in this excavation, you found a trash heap 2 feet thick, which was a real heart of the gold mine here. What did you find in that trash heap?
People live on top of their own garbage. Modern people do, and prehistoric people did too. And this village probably was there for perhaps a decade or more. And the stuff that they used and threw away accumulated mostly in they dug storage pits and then filled them with trash again. But they also rebuilt their houses, leveling what was there and putting a new house on top. So
houses made of
probably poles and bark, perhaps. It's a little hard to tell because all we have is the impression of the house now. Mm. But when they move trash around and level it and rebuild it on top, why then you get an accumulation of debris. And this site had that accumulation completely preserved. The plow had gone right over the top of the village, so we got the whole thing.
So in the trash you find, again, the bone fragments, they've been eating animals, some tools. What else would you find in there, in the trash?
A lot of debris from making tools, not only bone that's been worked and shaped into tools, but also an awful lot of chipping debris. They bring chert, which is the material they make stone tools out of, down into the floodplain in large quantities and then chip it. And we get all the chipping debris as well as the broken tools as well. And then there's a lot of pottery on these sites. The pottery is all broken into sherds and scattered around. So we got thousands and thousands of pottery sherds out of this site.
We'd like you to join our conversation if you have a question about this specific dig, this great find near Oakville, or you have a question about archaeology in general. Please give us a ring, 1-866-780-9100. Dave Benn and Joe Arts are with us until half past the hour. Please call now if you have that question or comment, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.com. Who are the descendants of these people? You call them the Weavers? The Weavers or the Weaver people?
W-E-A-V-E-R. That's just an archaeological term. You know, these people lived 1,000 years before we can identify the Iowa Indians in Iowa, even in the protohistoric period. So it's a stretch to be able to identify these people with a particular tribe. Perhaps they were the descendants of the Iowa, or perhaps some other Midwestern group. It's hard to say right now.
Are there any bones or remains of the actual people here? Any burials on this site?
No.
Nothing?
They tended to bury folks up on the bluff line rather than down in the floodplain. At least these folks did. And we were fortunate not to run into burials, because running into human bones in archaeological sites is a controversial matter, and it's just as well that we don't find any.
So you're glad not to, because that means you can go full tilt into excavating it without having to treat it as a burial site.
That's right. Burial sites have federal and state protection, and when you get into those kinds of things, it's a whole different administrative matter.
Okay. Dave Benn is a research archaeologist with Bear Creek Archaeology. That's a private company based in Cresco that does archaeology work. Also, Joe Arzt with us of the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa, talking about this wonderful new find, a new site near Oakville in southeastern Iowa. Tells us what life is like, was like, perhaps 1,700 years ago. When we come back, I want to have Dave and Joe tell us from what they can guess from these finds, these over 200,000 artifacts recently discovered, what life was actually like. Were these a peaceful people? How did they feed themselves? What did they do during the day? We'll find out about that and also go to your calls when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. This is an archive edition of The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio, talking about, in this first half hour, Oak Village, I think it's termed, a new archaeological dig near Oakville, Iowa, in southeastern part of the state, a 1,700-year-old village uncovered. Over 200,000 artifacts were released from the ground and are being studied now in January and February. Dave Benn with us, a research archaeologist, also Joe Arzt, of the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa. Before we go to calls, quickly, describe what you think life would have been like in this village 1,700 years ago. You must imagine this when you're going through the bone fragments, the tools, peaceful people. What was their daily routine?
Yeah, I think these folks were very peaceful. They spent a good deal of their day collecting food and taking care of their children and meeting with folks out in the plaza, and they did all the things that we do in normal everyday life, except they didn't have to drive cars around and waste their time on freeways somewhere.
Good for them.
These people lived well. They lived rich lives. They fished a lot. They grew their own food, and in the fall and the winter. They hunted deer, and they sat around in their houses during the cold spell, and I think they lived good lives.
Sounds like you might have wanted to live. Had you lived then, you would have been a fine village to live in.
Well, archaeology is a little like that, trying to be like the people you dig up.
Okay, let's go to our first call in Fairfield. Jay is with us. Hi, Jay. Thanks for joining the program.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, go ahead.
My question is I kind of wonder why you haven't touched on this. It's like, what were their housing? What kind of houses? The mud huts or, you know, teepees or what did they have?
We did touch on that, Jay, but perhaps he can expand on this.
Okay.
I think they built what we would call a wigwam, like in the Song of Hiawatha, pole lodge covered with bark. We don't have any evidence for mud daub on the houses or anything. They certainly didn't use stone to build their houses. So these are fairly simple houses that you could throw up in a day or two and would be easily reconstructed.
So is that not a circular teepee like we think of? It's something like a square, rectangular type thing?
These houses at this time period were more like oval sorts of shaped structures. They probably might have been really similar to what the Meskwaki, for example, were living in at the time of European contact, and the kind of reconstructions of those houses that you can see at like Living History Farms or up at the Big River Museum in Dubuque. Those are really good examples of what those houses might have looked like 1,700 years ago.
So they weren't like wooden. They were mostly like animal skins, like a teepee would be.
Pole construction, arched, you know, poles bent over, and perhaps covered with bark, mm-hmm. or a thatch sticks and then or grass.
Thank you, Jay, calling from Fairfield. Let's move to Randy, calling from Iowa County. Hi, Randy.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Over the years on the farm and around this area, I occasionally find small projectile arrowheads. Never found a tomahawk. Did you find any of that kind of stuff down that way?
We did find one axe, a small one. Mostly we found spear points. These people were using the atlatl, the spear thrower, and probably darts rather than the bow and arrow. This is pre-bow and arrow.
Mm. So the bow and arrow was not
killing mm-hmm. buffalo and elk if they were around, and bear and that kind of stuff, right?
Mostly deer, perhaps an elk or two. Buffalo probably are not in this area this early. They come in closer to the historic period. When they crossed the Mississippi River, these people ate a lot of deer, but they mainly ate fish.
Mm-hmm.
Huge amounts of fish.
When was the bow and arrow invented, if not at 1700?
Well, it comes in at 700 or 800 AD or so, about 1200 years ago.
And
so,
what's the fish hooks look like?
There are no fish hooks. The fish in this site are of every size, and I think they were taken with nets.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randy, calling from Iowa County. How do you tell, or is there a way to tell, tools such as spears or an axe, hunting with it as opposed to war? How do you tell tools of war from tools of hunting?
Well, you dig up the bodies and you find the arrow points in the bodies. That's about the surest way of telling that there's been warfare going on, or perhaps a fortification around the site. This site does not have a fortification. And we don't know very much about their burials, so we can't really say much about warfare at this time. Warfare does become a common thing later on in the prehistoric period. This period, it's uncertain right now.
Mm-hmm. Do we know why these people? You said they were perhaps there perhaps a decade. Do we know why they moved? It wasn't a sudden die-out or something that caused them to...
No, these folks move their villages regularly.
Okay.
Whether the garbage gets to be too much or the deer run out in a particular area or mm-hmm. their fields become too weedy. There are many reasons for moving a village, but these villages got moved frequently.
Ron Riverdale. Ron is calling from Riverdale. Hi, Ron.
Good morning.
Good morning. We've got just a couple minutes. What do you got for us?
Curious to know what's going to happen to the site. Will it be covered by a levee? That's it.
Okay, thank you, Ron. You fed right into the concluding part of our discussion, because this has actually already been covered over again. After your eight-week excavation, what happened?
The trench was backfilled. The location has been flooding all spring and summer, and they haven't been able to rebuild the levee yet. Soon the levee will be rebuilt. It will be set on top of the site, and the site will probably be nominated to the National Register of Historic Places, so it will be preserved.
Well, excuse me. What does that mean for the future then, that you only took a cross-section? Why not excavate the whole thing before the levee is built?
Takes a lot of time to excavate the entire.
It's just too much of an area.
Too much of an area, and I mean you have to make a choice between whether you're going to dig a whole lot of area fast, or dig a smaller area with more detail.
Mm-hmm.
And usually we err on the side of precision, getting what I mean. You can only dig it once, so you have to dig it well.
Mm-hmm.
So the choice that we usually make is to excavate a smaller area rather than a larger area.
Is there any thought to, and I know this with other finds, that perhaps in the future you preserve that because they will have other better means to excavate and evaluate in the future? Is that also a thought?
That's normally the reasoning, but we also have a practical matter here. There's only so much money and so much time, and you can't dig everything up. So archaeologists spend a lot of time sampling,
mm-hmm.
and this trench through this site is a sample. And with 200,000 or 300,000 artifacts, really don't need more stuff than that to tell you what's really going on the site.
Any myth-busting artifacts here, things that made you go, wow, I guess that reverses what we've thought about the Weaver people?
I wouldn't say that we were looking for anything spectacular. What we were looking for was the village pattern and the community pattern, and that's what we got.
Mm-hmm.
We got the ring of houses and an open area in the center, which has not been confirmed at many of these Weaver sites.
So is that really the biggest find for you here, the architecture of this community?
The map.
The
yes.
map.
The map, yeah. The map is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And describe why it's cool for you.
Well, you don't get to section a whole village very often. Go side to side and right through the center of it. That's a fairly rare thing. Usually we put in little square holes in a site, and you really don't know what's going on in the rest of it. This one we got all the way across.
Any guesses on how many people lived here about in this village? 100?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps 200.
200 people.
Maybe. I don't know.
Okay. This is fascinating work. We'll look forward to talking to you in the future as you find maybe other great digs in the state. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Dave Benn, research archaeologist with Bear Creek Archaeology, based in Cresco. Joe Arts, he is with the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And coming up in just a moment, well, the phone rings. A voice on the other end tells you, you're the recipient of a $500,000 MacArthur Fellowship, no strings attached. We'll talk to someone who that happened to, Timothy Barrett. He'll be joining me in just a moment. We'll find out about how he got on the MacArthur list, became a fellow, and a recipient of a $500,000 over the next 5 years. This is The Exchange. This is an archive edition of The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. The phone rings. A voice on the other end tells you, you're the recipient of a $500,000 MacArthur Fellowship. No strings attached to that money. That is what happened to Timothy Barrett. Tim Barrett is a research scientist and adjunct professor of papermaking at the University of Iowa Center for the Book. The recipient now of a 2009 $500,000 MacArthur Fellowship, popularly known as Genius Grants, one of only two dozen given each year. They are awarded to individuals who have shown exceptional originality and dedication to their creative pursuits. Iowa's newest MacArthur Fellow, Tim Barrett joins me in the studio this morning. Congratulations to you.
Thanks a lot, Ben. I'm happy to be here.
The phone call. Tell us about that. This, I understand, took place last week.
Yeah.
And you're sitting at home? The phone
rings?
Well,
no. As a matter of fact, appropriately, I was with four of my colleagues at the Center for the Book here at the university and in the middle of a meeting, and my cell phone rang, and I immediately pushed the button to shut it up, and it rang again, and I thought, someone's trying to reach me. I was concerned that one of my kids was sick at school, so I went out in the hallway and took it, and this voice says, this is Daniel Socolow at the MacArthur Foundation. Is this Timothy Barrett? And I said, yes. And he said, are you sitting down? And I said, no, but I'm going to sit down. He said, are you familiar with the MacArthur Fellowships? And I said, I am indeed. And he said, do you know anyone who's received one? And I said, well, actually, Terry Bellinger at the University of Virginia, I know him. And he said, well, you know someone with the initials TB who's received one. And I said, right, well, that would be Terry Bellinger. Now, come on, you got to help me out here a little bit. He said, well, congratulations. I'm pleased to tell you you've received the MacArthur Fellowship. And so I spoke with him for about 15 minutes, and then at the end of the conversation, he said, now don't tell anyone about this.
For how long?
For a week. So I had to go back into my meeting with my colleagues and not say anything.
Not have a silly expression on your face?
And act normal, yeah. So last week I've been trying to act normal. And when I got out of the meeting, I went outside and called my wife, and her immediate response was, no way. You're joking.
Right. I mean, the first reaction would be disbelief. They make it clear to you on the phone that it's not a prank. Because
that's right.
That's a possibility.
They have the decency to send you a written letter by FedEx the next morning just so you can be convinced you're not dreaming. But it was a pretty big deal, no doubt about it.
Okay. Tell us about your passion that gained the attention of the MacArthur Foundation, your research, your work in papermaking. Your specialty is papermaking, the history of the techniques, the aesthetics of all the types of paper that humankind has produced throughout history.
Yeah, I'm part of a community of people that are have invested a lot of time and energy in the study of papermaking. Some of them are paper artists, some are paper historians, some are trying to make their livings at producing and selling handmade paper. My personal focus is the history and technique of Japanese and early European papermaking. But, to receive this grant means a lot to the whole community. Mm-hmm. I've been very interested in aesthetics associated with handmade papers. Why does one paper seem to have more authenticity or integrity than another? With paper stability, why are some papers much more permanent than others? So coming here to the University of Iowa Center for the Book back in 1986 kind of fit with what was going on here, and I felt very, very lucky to be able to pursue my interests as part of the university.
As you well know, public radio listeners are also lovers of books and lovers of paper. We'd like to invite our listeners right now to ask any questions or comments about paper making or books. If you'd like to talk to Tim Barrett, 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. How many different ways are there to make paper?
Well, historically, there have been, hundreds and hundreds of ways. But essentially, it all boils down to the same process, including machine paper making. I mean, essentially, you have to have cellulose fiber that's been beaten or macerated in water. You have to suspend it in a volume of water and then strain it out again in a flat, even layer and dry it. And there have been various techniques developed in different countries at different times. In Asia, at a certain point in the history of the craft, we're not exactly sure when this happened, probably around the year 700, they discovered that if you added a viscous solution to the vat, formation aid, you could make very thin, long fibered sheets. And the development of that technique was a big event in the history of the craft.
When did that happen about?
Well, we think it was about the year 700.
Mm-hmm. And made that such a landmark? And what could paper then do thereafter that it couldn't do before?
Well, they were able to make these thin, as I said, long fibered sheets that were – and to make the pulp last longer, thin tissues produced in Asian countries, especially in Japan, is used a lot in conservation work. And you can't make that same kind of paper using the Western or European technique. And I spent a couple of years in Japan under a Fulbright studying that technique because it was so different from what we were used to doing in hand papermaking in America, in the West in general.
Talk to Tim Barrett. Ask him a question about papermaking, the history of the technique of papermaking, 1-866-780-9100. He's with us until the end of the hour, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. David is joining us from Iowa City. Good morning, David.
Yes, hello.
Yes, hello. You're on the air. Welcome to our program. You have a question or a comment for Mr. Barrett.
Well, yeah, I have a comment, not a question, and he may already be recognizing my voice just as I recognize his.
Good morning, David.
How are you doing?
Fine.
I just want to say that part of what makes Mr. Barrett so remarkable is not only is he an incredibly interesting researcher, but he's an unbelievably dedicated teacher. You know, we have at universities like ours this sense that so many of the professors and people on the faculty are committed to their research and do their teaching more or less unwillingly, and that's not the case with him. I took his papermaking class some years ago when I was in the Master's of Fine Arts program at the university, and he told all of us, my cell phone number's posted here on the wall. If when you're working in the lab you have problems, give me a call. And several times I would have problems and I would give him a call and he would say, well, I'm leaving Oakdale right now. I'll be over in 15 minutes to help you out. And he would come into the lab and show me how to work with the Japanese paper that I was attempting really clumsily to make. And it was just marvelous to watch him, first of all, but then to know that he was willing to go that far out of his way to help me understand something that really is pretty interesting and pretty difficult to get one's Western mind around.
David, thank you so much for that memory of having Tim Barrett as a teacher. Thank you so much. David calling from Iowa City.
Yeah, thanks, David.
Let's go to Gene. I think you're on the road, right, Gene? Gene, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, sir. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I'm driving on I-35, and I'm a University of Iowa graduate living in Minnesota. We have a Center for the Book in Minneapolis, close to the University of Minnesota's campus. And I was curious as to how widespread the interest is in the U.S. In papermaking, bookmaking, its history, cultivation, artistic merit. My wife has given me a couple nicely done handmade books with great paper. So I was curious to see how widespread this interest is.
Well, of course, I don't have any statistics, but it's my – and I'm a little bit biased being part of the Center for the Book here and because of my specialty. But it's my sense that in the midst of all this digital stuff going on and the development of Kindle and all kinds of things, the interest in handmade books – in the history of the paper-based book and even in the future of the paper-based book is not waning. In fact, it's growing. My sense is that in another 10 years when the Kindle is turned into some sort of 3D holographic device, if you want to give someone a really special gift, it will be a handmade journal. Or if you're trying to get that woman really interested in you, you'll give her a card – hand calligraphed card on handmade paper, and she'll look at that, and she will pay attention to.
Could it be something to something you could equate that with, for instance, getting a handwritten letter in the mail these days instead of an email?
That's a pretty big
deal. You get a handwritten letter these days, and you think this is really special.
Yeah,
you don't want to throw it away.
Yeah, right.
So something like that, maybe.
Yeah.
My wife is a great advocate of handwriting for the same reason that you just mentioned.
Yeah. Well, see, I might interject here that my colleague at the University of Virginia, Terry Bellinger, who also is a MacArthur Fellow recipient, said that the fish in the tank don't realize there's water there until the level begins to drop. So I think that there is something to growing interest in handmade books and paper and calligraphy.
Gene, thank you for your question and your thoughts.
Thank you.
1-866-780-9100. Tim Barrett, you will get a total of $500,000 over the next 25 years. Every quarter, I think, you get a check for?
Yeah, $25K.
$25K. Yeah. Show up for you to cash. Yeah. If you had time to think of what you'd like to do with this money, it's only been a few days.
Yeah, it's really hard to get your head around. My son actually has the most level-headed response. He said, I want to raise my allowance. That was his immediate reaction.
Granted, as long as it's...
Yeah, one of the things I want to do, of course, is try to stretch it out and make it last longer than 5 years. I've always wanted to write a book about Western papermaking, and this will certainly facilitate drawings and photography and some related travel. There are some experiments in process right now for which funds are running out that I'd like to continue, and one or two that I've always wanted to do that are going to be hard – would have been hard to implement otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Past the personal ramifications of getting this prestigious award and the financial thing, it brings a lot of recognition not only to you but to the center of the book and the Center for the Book in the state of Iowa. There are impacts there as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. And we're very excited about it, of course, here at the Center for the Book. We have a very unique program. Many of the competing universities that host book studies programs are focused either on the book arts, papermaking, bookbinding, letterpress printing, or on the history of the book, print culture studies. And we're the only institution that's working to bring the two together. And it hasn't been done before. It seems obvious to us. But the University of Iowa has a reputation for doing things that haven't been done before. Mm-hmm. The MFA graduate degrees in studio art and creative writing were done here first and are now modeled to other universities around the country. And we think exactly the same thing can happen with book studies.
Gene mentioned there's also a Center of the Book at the University of Minnesota. How many centers for books are there in the country? And well, where does Iowa land in that context?
Right. The center he's mentioning, unless I'm mistaken, is a public access kind of facility where people can go and work and learn the various book arts. Ours here is an academic or a program based in an academic institution that involves teaching and research on the part of the related faculty. So it's kind of a different type of center, and I would say there are four or five institutions that have programs somewhat like ours. Most of the competing programs grant terminal degrees in the specialty, in the book arts. We have better facilities, more diverse curriculum, and some exceptional staff, and yet we don't grant a terminal degree here. So this is something that's going to be front and center, I hope, in the next few weeks and months, because it's something we have in motion and really want to accomplish here at the U. It'd be good for the state and good for the university.
Pete is joining us from Galesburg, Illinois. A question, a comment for Tim Barrett. Pete, you there?
Yes, Dr. Barrett. I don't know if you've got an opinion on this question, but because of your specialty being the fine art aspect of paper, I presume. But papermaking itself is one of the most energy, water, and resource-intensive activities that our human race is now involved in. And I wonder what you see ecologically in its future, if anything.
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. I might mention it's not Dr. Barrett. It's just Tim. But that's fine. The paper industry, of course, has been forced to make some major changes over the last several decades. And it wasn't that long ago, they used to consume a great deal of water to make a ton of paper. But now they recycle a lot of the water they use, recycle some of the materials that are used in-house to save energy. But there's a lot of interest now in non-paper alternatives to information exchange, and obviously the internet is starting to help a lot with getting information out there when everything used to be in print. But it's also true that paper will always be important. You can't – if you're looking at the – which technology is the most advanced, as my colleague Gary Frost likes to point out, the book printed or written on paper will last far, far longer than the CD or the iPod. So I think papermaking is going to be with us for a while, and no doubt about it, the industry is obligated to try to figure out how to do it in a more environmentally friendly way.
Gary joins us from Mason City. Good morning, Gary. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, I don't mean to tweak you, but you sound just the way us newspaper guys sounded about 5 years ago. And look where we are today. Hey, I was up in Brainerd, Minnesota, and they closed a paper mill up there. And I just wonder if that's a sign of the times.
Well, you know, I think it probably is that there are a lot of electronic media versions of what always used to be done in print. It would be interesting to know what's going on nationally with paper mills, and unfortunately I don't have that kind of information, but certainly there's some big changes that we're in the middle of right now.
Okay. Hey, another question. I used to work for a guy back when newspapers had an editor on one side and a print shop on the other, and he would hold the paper up to the light, and he'd tell you what kind it was, where it was from, and how good it was. Is that still a skill, and was he just maybe putting me on a little bit?
No, not at all. You know, it's very interesting. If I get a letter from someone, and if it's obviously handmade or even if it's not, if there's anything unusual about it, the first thing I do is hold it up to the light because it tells you a lot about the quality of fiber preparation, the skill of the paper
maker. What are you looking for when you can see through the light? The fibers are arranged in a certain way?
Yeah, in general, you're looking for evenness of formation, which shows you that the fiber's been prepared the right way, it's been beaten to the right degree. If it was formed on a paper machine or on a hand mold, shaking it, having the right amount of water present is sort of a delicate balance. And if you don't do it right, then the sheet tends to look cloudy. If it has knots and clumps in it, it's an indication of sloppy workmanship or poor quality fiber preparation. Of course, it really depends on the final use of the paper. Brown craft paper is absolutely superior stuff if you're trying to make a shopping bag. And it may not look great when you hold it up to the light, but it's strong. So end use is really important to this conversation.
Thanks, Gary. Let's move to Eldon in Des Moines. Good morning, Eldon.
Good morning. I'd like to ask if there's a text or a book I can get to find out more about this subject.
There is an excellent book, a Dover reprint that's quite inexpensive, costs about $12 or $13, called Papermaking, History and Technique of an Ancient Craft by Dard Hunter. Dard Hunter was absolutely nuts about hand papermaking history and technique, and in the 30s and 40s he traveled all over the world collecting equipment and investigating variations on the hand papermaking theme, and you won't be disappointed if you're curious about it. He's really the godfather of this whole hand papermaking thing, and to a very large extent, the book arts, contemporary book arts as well.
Thank you very much.
Eldon, thank you for calling from Des Moines. As we end this hour, what's the future of paper? We talked a little bit about the future of books. You know, we had this predictions in the 1980s when we had the advent of the digital age and the start of computers that there was going to be the paperless offices, and it turned out to be exactly the opposite. We use more paper than ever. But are there any advances in paper that we're still looking for, or have we arrived? We know how to do it, or is there a holy grail out there? I wish paper could have this characteristic that it doesn't have now.
Yeah. I obviously, as we were discussing earlier, the paper trade needs to figure out how to make paper in a more environmentally friendly way, and furthermore, paper will always be one of the most stable ways to preserve information for the long-term future. The topic that's really interesting to me is what's going to happen to the book. You know, what will books look like? And I think that the Center for the Book is equally interested in the history and the future of the book. And I think the people who design books of the future are going to be people who first really understand the history of books and the impact on society and culture, book design, and so on. So I think there will be paper-based books as well as e-books.
Does the UI Center for the Book embrace Kindle, for instance?
Well, we're very interested in where Kindle's headed, but what we're interested in really is putting together a team of people who can design what will be next, what goes beyond the Kindle. The big problem with Kindle, I think, is that it's not user-friendly. It's not as user-friendly as the classic traditional codex book. You're not probably as inclined to curl up in bed with the Kindle as you may be with a traditional book. And therefore, the question is, well, what is it about this older form that is so user-friendly? And I think there's a lot of work to be done, and a group like the team here at the UI can make it happen.
We don't have much time left, but is it possible to synthesize the technology with a page so that you could have some electronics working on a thin page at all?
Well, there's a lot of digital paper that's being worked on now, and once it starts to look and feel more attractive, I think we're going to be heading in that direction.
Tim Barrett, thanks so much for coming in to join us. And
my pleasure,
once again,
Ben.
Congratulations on this great honor, not only for you, but for the Center for the Book, for the University of Iowa and the state of Iowa. Thank you for your passion, your creativity, and where it will take you and the Center for the Book in the future. Tim Barrett, thanks.
Thank you, Ben. My pleasure.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins with help from Julie Englander and John Pemble, our producer assistant today, Thane Hines. Technical support also from Dennis Reese. Podcasting available. If you didn't catch all of the conversations today on our program and would like to, go to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.